This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. Washington Wise from Charles Schwab is an original podcast that unpacks the stories making news there. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee said on Friday that Fani Willis could remain on her case to prosecute President Trump in Georgia, but only if her former boyfriend and fellow prosecutor Nathan Wade exits. Plus, later, we'll talk to our colleague Elliot Kaufman about the latest in the war in Israel and the reaction in Israel to Chuck Schumer's speech calling for Netanyahu, the prime minister, to go. Welcome to Potomac Watch. I'm Kate Batchelder-Odell, and I'm joined today by my talented colleague, editorial board member, Mine Ukweberua. Friday, we got a 25-page ruling from Judge Scott McAfee that dealt with the issue of whether Fani Willis was compromised in her case on prosecuting President Trump. The question has been over her involvement with another prosecutor on the case, Nathan Wade, and there were hearings about this question about the nature of their relationship and when it began, since some of the defendants in the case alleged a financial impropriety because Fani had gone on trips with Mr. Wade and that he had paid for, and that fatally compromised the case. The judge didn't agree with that in Friday's ruling. He said that it was basically too extraordinary a remedy to throw Fani Willis off the case, but that her former boyfriend, Nathan Wade, did need to leave the case to avoid the appearance of impropriety. And Judge McAfee lambasted Fani Willis's judgment and also her performance on the stand. Mine, reading this, not a wholesale victory for Trump, not what Trump wanted, but how do you read whether the case really can continue or how it will go forward now that we've had this really bruising mark on Fani Willis's judgment played out so publicly?
Well, I think you're exactly right to separate the substance of the ruling, which did uphold the claims that the defense made about Fani Willis and her relationship with Nathan Wade, and it called for Nathan Wade's removal from the case, from how it's going to be received publicly. Because I think in the first case, you can reasonably say that the judge, Scott McAfee, came to the right decision in saying that Fani Willis violated her duties as a prosecutor by essentially creating the appearance of impropriety by going on these trips with Nathan Wade. He was obviously being paid out of her office, and she was benefiting from that in some way, even if he was splitting the costs with her, which she alleges and is able to show to a certain extent. It is just not acceptable ever for a public official to be directly involved with someone who's on their payroll in a romantic way. And it made sense that she was basically criticized by the judge in charge of hearing the case for that kind of conduct and forced to remove Nathan Wade from the case. But at the same time, it's clear that she didn't necessarily violate any clear statute in doing so. And he pointed to several other instances where there had been conflicts of interest or near conflicts in which prosecutors were still able to continue moving ahead on a case and were not removed. He decided to condemn her in the ruling, make sure that Nathan Wade can no longer be directly involved, but stopped short of saying that the case should be thrown out, which is what Trump's defense team suggested, or that Fani Willis herself has to be removed from it. But there is a broader question of the appearance of public disorder surrounding the case, which has continued to grow, because Fani Willis also had certain charges in the indictment against Trump removed by the same judge just a couple of days before. It just seems like a very poorly run show. And the public, which is going to be watching the case, and certain members will be appointed to the jury before it moves into trial, is clearly seeing that she did not really have her act together in terms of how they decided to go about it. And she's not really seen as a professional who has the ability to prosecute the case successfully against the former president. And so the court of public opinion, I think, already saw this as a politicized move to bring Trump under charges for his conduct in the aftermath of the election in Georgia. And that appearance is only increasing, particularly among people who are already skeptical. So it's going to contribute to the sense of disorder around the case. There still isn't a trial date set, and it seems like it's not going to really have the impact that Trump's critics hoped it would have in terms of convicting him, not only under the letter of the law, but in the eyes of the public.
I certainly agree it'll leave some lasting damage in the court of public opinion. And there were elements of the testimony that were quite difficult to piece together or understand. I mean, for instance, Fani Willis describes some of these trips that she went on with Nathan Wade and said that she paid him back in cash that she keeps at her home. This is certainly possible, but a little odd for how most people operate their finances these days. And all sorts of elements like this that were just quite odd and I think did draw more public scrutiny on the case. There's one other element I think about her judgment implicated in this case I think we should talk about. And for that, why don't we listen to a short clip of something that Fani Willis had to say about the case in public that the judge would comment on. Let's take a listen and we'll talk about the substance in a minute.
I appointed three special counsel, as is my right to do, paid them all the same hourly rate. They only attacked one. I hired one white woman, a good personal friend and great lawyer. A superstar, I tell you. I hired one white man, brilliant, my friend and a great lawyer. And I hired one black man, another superstar, a great friend, and a great lawyer. Oh Lord, they gonna be mad when I call them out on this nonsense. First thing they say, oh, she gonna play the race card now. But no, God, isn't it them who's playing the race card when they only question one?
Well, the judge was quite harsh on Fani Willis's decision to make these public remarks about the case and even raise the possibility of a gag order coming that would bar the prosecutor from discussing this case in public. One other thing I'd add, Monet, too, is that we don't know if Trump will appeal, but this could potentially drag out the legal process for quite some time. And she may have even given Trump some basis on which to eventually appeal a conviction, even if that were to come before the election, which looks unlikely at this point. So, just on a practical matter, do you think we will see a gag order in this case, or how else might it complicate the path forward here?
I would be surprised if Judge McAfee decided to gag Fani Willis, despite the fact that she clearly was acting inappropriately by saying that her critics were playing the race card in public or by speaking about the case in public at all. I do think that his hope will be that the ruling, which did find her responsible for violation of ethics and also ordered her to dismiss Nathan Wade from the case, will be sufficient to restrain her conduct in the future, that she probably already realizes that she's on thin ice and is not going to be making public appearances and statements of that kind. And so, of course, judges are reluctant to issue gags unless they think that they're completely necessary. In this case, he'll probably want to be restrained and think she will stay within the lines of ethical conduct without my having to order an official gag. But in terms of the timing of the case, you're definitely right. There was already doubt about whether there was a possibility of the trial beginning by the end of the year because of Trump's other legal problems. Obviously, he's facing charges in four other jurisdictions. And there is a jostling among these different prosecutors and judges about exactly when each case can begin. And it seemed as if Georgia was already going to defer to some of these earlier cases. The first one to begin will be in New York toward the end of March, although that now is facing a possible delay. And then the DC case, once the Supreme Court has weighed in, probably will follow after that. But now that we've had these disruptions with deciding whether Fani Willis is able to stay on the case at all, it's much likelier that there's going to be a subsequent delay in the beginning of the Georgia case. And so it now is very, very unlikely that it will begin before the election, if in 2024 at all. And also, as you mentioned, it is very possible that Trump's team is going to continue to cite the evidence of her ethical breaches in a possible appeal. And so the strength of the case and the timeline seem to have been deeply damaged by her misconduct. And it's just incredible to think that she wouldn't have considered these possibilities when she was making those horrible decisions of getting involved with Nathan Wade in the first place.
And just briefly, Monet, turning to the politics a little bit of this, we now have this case, which for all the reasons we've discussed, has serious credibility problems in the court of public opinion. Alvin Bragg's case has been criticized roundly. It's a campaign finance bank shot that I don't think most voters can even really grasp what he's trying to prove, let alone think it's substantive. And then you have the classified documents case, which have potentially a little bit more substance to them. But I guess my question is, are these indictments completely baked into the public's decision-making already anyway, because Republicans have concluded that there's not a lot of credibility to them? Or do you think that the possibility of a potential conviction really could move the needle for some voters in the coming months?
I think it's largely the first. Just about anyone who's paying attention to politics has a firm opinion on one side or the other, either that Trump is being completely railroaded by the Justice Department under the Biden administration and other progressive prosecutors, and that they're cooking up show trials just for the sake of hanging him high and removing him from contention, or the opposite, and that Trump is a gross criminal, always has been long before he was elected to the presidency, and that these prosecutors are doing exactly the right thing by finding whatever charges they're able to stick to him and doing a service to the American public by removing him from contention. I think just about every American voter can be sorted at least loosely into one bucket or the other, and there are a few who are still waiting to make up their minds. I do think that there probably is the possibility that Trump will do or say something during the course of these trials as they move forward that could make people start paying even more attention, that could discredit him in some of the eyes of his more reluctant supporters. Americans don't like the idea of electing a president who is a convicted felon. Even a lot of Trump supporters would feel very uncomfortable doing that. But I still think at the end of the day, you have to say that these trials are going to have very, very little sway on even swing voters, and that we're in for a lot of chaos, a lot of commentary, all of which amounts to very little change in the outcome of the presidential election.
Well, on that happy note, thanks, Monet. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back to talk about Israel in a moment.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kind of heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
Welcome back to Potomac Watch. I'm Kate Batchelder-Odell. I'm hosting today, and I'm about to talk to my colleague, Elliot Kaufman, who is fresh off a trip to Israel about the developments there in Israel's war and Israel's relationship with the United States. So, Elliot, thank you so much for joining us. I believe you're relatively fresh off a plane, so hopefully you've had a moment to figure out what time and day it is and where you are. But we're glad to have you. And in the past 24 hours, the biggest news item in the U.S.-Israel relationship has obviously been the Democratic Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, who went to the U.S. Senate floor and basically called for Netanyahu's ouster from Prime Minister of Israel. So let's listen to a quick clip of what Chuck Schumer had to say.
There needs to be a fresh debate about the future of Israel after October 7th. In my opinion, that is best accomplished by holding an election. Now, if Prime Minister Netanyahu's current coalition remains in power after the war begins to wind down and continues to pursue dangerous and inflammatory policies that test existing U.S. standards for assistance, then the United States will have no choice but to play a more active role in shaping Israeli policy by using our leverage to change the present course.
Well, Schumer really waded right in there to Democratic allies' electoral process. So, Elliot, I've got a small idea of how this perhaps went over in Israel, but why don't you give us some more detail on how Mr. Schumer's remarks are being received so far?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Kate. There are plenty of Israelis who would agree with Senator Schumer. There are plenty who would disagree. But I think what they would all say is that it's not his place. It's not his country. He doesn't get to say when Israel has an election, when a government has to fall, when the country's policy has to change. And so you've seen Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's leading opponents, people who would usually be more than happy to say bad things about him, have to come and sort of rally to his side here. Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's chief opponent, coming out and saying that this is a decision for Israelis to make, not an American senator, no matter how powerful. Former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, another Netanyahu opponent, coming out and saying, Israel is not a banana republic. America doesn't get to dictate what happens in this way. So if the intent was to undermine the prime minister, I don't think it has succeeded in Israel. Israelis don't like to hear their country given orders about basic democratic processes.
Right. I mean, one of the things I find fascinating about this speech from Schumer is that if you read the full text of it, the first half of it is actually a remarkably cogent defense of Israel's existence, that it's not a 20th century invention, and a very clear-eyed description of Israel's enemies and what they face against Hamas. And Schumer recalls things like when he was younger, listening over the radio about whether Israel was going to win the 6 days war. So what kind of boggles my mind is that he kept going. And obviously, the speech is not remembered for any of those features that I'm describing now. So this is, I guess, more of a question about the American left, but there's clearly some sort of change going on among Democrats, among the Biden administration in their posture toward Israel. Can you give us any more understanding of how maybe America's bent toward Israel has changed over the past couple of weeks?
You're absolutely right about there being two sides to Senator Schumer's speech. And I think you have to read it in the context of a campaign by President Biden over the past several weeks, month, maybe a month and a half, to really up the rhetorical ante against Israel. Except he would put it differently. He would say it's against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And the truth is, that plays well with American liberals. Not only the anti-Israel left, but American liberals in general, who have come to a situation where you can really say anything about Prime Minister Netanyahu and it's okay. The problem is, what Netanyahu is being attacked for aren't things where he is on one side and the Israeli people are on another. That's what President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris have tried to argue. But on every issue they pick, those are the issues where Netanyahu is actually aligned with Israelis. On issues like what to do about Rafah, Hamas's final stronghold in Gaza. On issues like a Palestinian state now, Israelis find that idea absolutely crazy. They can't believe an American would think that's a good idea right now. And even on things like humanitarian aid, where I would argue the prime minister is actually out in front of where Israelis are. Most Israelis don't like the idea of sending in humanitarian aid while their hostages are still suffering there, 150 days in. Netanyahu is sending aid. And so by attacking the prime minister on these issues, they're really undermining their argument that the U.S. problem is just with Netanyahu and not with Israel.
I thought your point in your piece for us, Elliot, was brilliant, that folks assume that if Netanyahu were gone, that they'd get somebody who were closer in agreement with the Biden administration, but in turn, the reality might be quite the opposite. You mentioned Rafah, and President Biden declared it would be a red line, which is an odd thing to say to an ally of any variety, as opposed to an adversary. But maybe you could give us a little bit more insight into what Israel is planning in Rafah, what the potential for Israel to go into Rafah is, and how that pressure not to go into Rafah is actually playing there, whether it's having any effect or maybe the opposite effect in giving more Israel resolve that it really does need to finish the job of eliminating the threat of Hamas.
Yes. So the Israeli war effort has two goals. One of them is to destroy Hamas. The other is to free the hostages that Hamas has been holding. These two objectives sometimes go hand in hand and sometimes not. So Rafah, the argument is you can't destroy Hamas if you're going to leave it an entire city as a stronghold where it has an estimated 40% of its military forces sitting, where its senior leadership is believed to be hiding, and where the hostages are believed to be held, most of them. So the argument from an Israeli perspective is very clear for why there has to be some sort of military operation against Rafah. However, there are all kinds of other strategies being pursued at the same time. The Biden administration, President Biden, really doesn't talk about destroying Hamas anymore. he did at the start of the war, and it really gave Israelis a boost of morale. President Biden went there to Israel, gave some very powerful speeches, but these days he just never mentions it. Victory, defeating Hamas, that's simply fallen off of his list of priorities. Instead, he talks about humanitarian aid, and he talks about bringing the war to a close. Now, the way to do that for him is with some kind of hostage deal. And talks have been going on, and there's some progress lately, but one can never know. The way that these two issues intersect is that President Biden would like a hostage deal that comes with a six-week pause in the fighting and then use that to get a larger ceasefire. He's been fairly open about this. Now, his way to get there has been to pressure Israel. New policy measures, threats about suspending weapons shipments, escalating anti-Israel rhetoric. It's been pressure on Israel to try to get this sort of hostage deal. The problem is Hamas has seen that too. And so in the last several weeks, we've seen Hamas harden its negotiating stances and move further away from a deal. Why, after all, should Hamas go to a deal if Israel's threat of an invasion of its final stronghold, Rafah, is no longer credible? And so the Biden administration's actions are in some ways working at cross purposes with its goals.
Your point about victory just completely being absent from the discussion is a great larger point about the Biden administration's foreign policy in general, and reminds me of Ukraine, where victory has also dropped off as any sort of objective the U.S. should have. But we'll take a quick break and we'll be back talking more with Elliot about the war in Israel.
AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/wallstreet. Oracle.com/wallstreet.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back to Potomac Watch. I'm Kate Batchelder Odell, chatting here with my colleague Elliot Kaufman about the war in Israel. Elliot, one thing you mentioned in your last remarks was about these potential threats to cut off U.S. weapons support for Israel. Now, the Biden administration has been saying all of these bromides about we will never abandon Israel, but then sort of leaving it open to the possibility that they would cut off some weapon support or put restrictions on weapons or maybe supply things like Israel's Iron Dome interceptors to help it protect its cities, but lay off some more active support. My understanding and my own reporting is that Israel really could benefit and needs U.S. support on items like precision-guided munitions, whether that's artillery or guided bombs. I guess my question for you, having spent the week there, is how seriously are the Israelis taking those threats that maybe U.S. support won't be there? And what are Israel's options if that were to happen? How are they thinking about the potential unreliability of the Biden administration?
It's a good question. Lack of ammunition is one of the most serious threats to the Israeli war effort. And it has been almost right from the start. Now, this is talked about all the time in Israel, but not so much in America. When you talk to senior Israeli officials about this, political officials, military officials, ammunition is the one thing where they will signal to you how serious it is, so much so that they really can't say much. Now, what I've been able to hear is that in the first 2 weeks of the war effort, Israel was running dangerously low. I've spoken to reserve soldiers who were told their unit could only fire 10 rounds of artillery that day. They had a set quota they simply could not exceed. The question is, how did they get into a situation like this. And there are a few reasons. One of them is completely inadequate Israeli planning. They weren't ready for a real war, especially not on two fronts, because Israel has to hold so much ammunition in reserve for Hezbollah in the north. They can't simply use all of it on Hamas in the south. The second point, though, is that many of these U.S. ammunition stocks that were held in Israel were sent to Ukraine during that war. Now, that was a perfectly legitimate choice, but Israel found itself scrambling for these weapons that would have otherwise been on its own territory, U.S. weapons. The third thing I would point to is Israeli officials will say that U.S. ammunition transfers, well, there were many more of them at the start. They've been slower. There's been some stalling by the U.S. And now there are leaks every day in the U.S. press about weapons being cut off, conditioned. There was a U.S. policy change adding all sorts of strings to how the weapons can be used and so forth, not in a way that would take them away from Israel, but in a way that was aimed at Israel, seemingly to make it nervous. And so when you talk to Israelis, this is one of the number one issues that they say is holding up an operation on Rafah, holding up the war in general. They say that the war in Gaza would have been over months ago if the ammunition had arrived on the pace that they would have liked. And so it's kind of, in America anyway, one of the untold stories of the war and definitely one to watch going forward.
Fascinating stuff, Elliot, but slightly alarming. We've talked a lot on this podcast about the U.S.'s ammunition shortages and struggle to provide enough for Ukraine in artillery. So there's a global run on artillery, it seems like. One quick thing I want to ask you about here towards the end. We have this week, the Biden administration renewed that $10 billion sanctions waiver on Iran. A great theme of this podcast and our pages has been discussing the ways in which the Biden administration doesn't quite appreciate how Iran is driving events in the region and how Hamas is a subsidiary of Iran. How is that news? Has that had any effect in Israel? And is there any sense in Israel that the Biden administration is doing this two-step, you know, sanctions relief for Iran while it's supporting Israel? What is your view of that decision and how is it being received in Israel?
Well, the first thing that came to mind is something that an Israeli minister told me, and that is that strategically, the U.S. is still in October 6th. Israelis talk this way. They speak about the October 6th army, or if they're talking about the future, the October 8th army. What is it going to look like? The U.S., I'm afraid he's right. Strategically, the Biden administration is still in October 6th. It hasn't changed its perception of Iran. It hasn't fundamentally changed its policy toward Iran. It still thinks that concessions can be made to sort of buy quiet, or if not quiet totally, then quieter than it might otherwise be. And so a $10 billion sanctions waiver when Iran is financing a war against Israel on so many fronts, when its proxies are shooting on U.S. troops and have been shooting on U.S. troops. I mean, it's hard to understand how the U.S. could think it's a good idea to allow more funds to go to Iran, because we know what it's going to do with it. One other point is that just lately, there have been these reports that the U.S. is threatening sanctions on Iran if it signs a ballistic missile deal with Russia to send ballistic missiles for Russia's use in Ukraine. Now, what Israelis have been saying is that these two policies in combination don't make any sense. Why is the U.S. with one hand giving a $10 billion sanctions waiver and with the other hand threatening ballistic missile sanctions? The policy just seems incoherent. And I think until the U.S., really the Biden administration, changes the way it conceives of this war, not of Hamas starting a war, Hezbollah joining in, but of the Iranian axis going to war with Israel and the U.S. in the region, we're going to continue to see this sort of policy incoherence.
Well, Elliot, it sounds like a fascinating and productive trip. Thanks so much for coming to fill us in. That's all for this week on Potomac Watch. We'll be back on Monday.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.